Well, aren't you a regular Nancy Drew?
I learned that from the Nancy Drew detective.
Okay, go.
You think you can follow the clues and solve the case of the missing condiment, Nancy Drew?
You guys have read every Nancy Drew mystery ever written.
Nancy, please tell me you're joking.
Wow, you suck at this Nancy Drew stuff. You should get a new hobby.
My name is Carson Drew, and this is my assistant, Nancy.
Nancy Drew.
It's curtains for you, Miss Drew.
Nancy Drew strikes again.
A regular Nancy Drew.
Hello, regular Drews.
Hi, everyone.
We're back for episode 78, and we are going to be talking about another Nancy Drew Digest, this one number 83, The Case of the Vanishing Veil. This one was published in 1988, and I just have to say, it shows.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
In a big way.
Yes.
Car phones, and honestly, the cars in general, just people driving limos everywhere, which I guess was something that people did in the 80s.
Well, rich people, at least, certainly.
Rich people. Mm-hmm. Which is, of course, it's a Nancy Drew book, so of course it's about rich people.
Yeah.
Like, couldn't be about a working class family. No, it's about wealthy people. No, what I was just about to say, though, is that this book is kind of wild.
It's very wild.
Like, it's just kind of intense and kind of weird. Like, some weird stuff happens. I think overall I liked it. I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't particularly feel super strongly about it in general. I think you could probably take it or leave it. But I think in general,
same.
I enjoyed it. But yeah. What did you think, Corey?
Well, I texted you this last week and you hadn't finished reading yet. So I didn't want to like get too detailed
get too
with
it.
Yeah. But I have a sneaking suspicion, and I have no real reason to believe this other than just the vibes that I get from the book. But I think that this maybe was like originally intended to be a file rather than a mystery story. And I will say maybe like 1 year prior to this, they published for the mystery stories. I think it was, and I'd have to double check the numbers and everything. I think number 77, Bluebeard Room, and 78, Phantom of Venice were originally intended to be backdoor pilots, essentially, for the Files series. So they were written to be a lot more heightened, a lot more dramatic, not quite to the level of the Files. You know, how they have like murders and all that kind of stuff. Not quite to that level, but it was kind of intended to be an introduction to the series. And just reading this, something about it. And again, this is like a year after that. This is book number 83. So a little bit further. Although they were all written really closely together in the same time period. I feel like maybe they tried to write this as a file and then looked at it and went, it's not quite as good as the other ones, not quite as dramatic as the other ones. Let's take out some of the more like violent or dangerous stuff and just rebrand it and just use it as our next mystery story. That's why it feels so wild to me, I think, is just because there are some like crazy things that happen that don't really pan out the way that they would in a file, but it's also just like way different than what you'd normally expect from a mystery story.
Yeah, I think that's, I had that thought. Because I got that text from you and I hadn't finished, but then after I finished, I kind of had like a separate but similar thought.
Okay.
That it does feel kind of like I'm reading a file, but not in a good way, like in a way that like this is not super distinguished from the files.
Exactly.
Like this is supposed to be a mystery story, but it feels kind of very similar to a Nancy Drew file. And so I am just kind of interested in this time period of Nancy Drew books in general.
Mm-hmm.
And like in general, I wonder, are these like Nancy Drew digests that happened? Like, cause the files started being published in 86, I think.
86 or 87, I believe.
Yeah. Just very soon before this. But of course there's this like overlap of time in the 80s and 90s where the files were happening alongside of the mystery story series. And so I'm like, how much of the stuff in the files is just like a product of their time, or was like, intended to be a different kind of Nancy Drew. And so what are the differences between the mystery stories at this time and the files, and what is due to the fact that it was the 80s and 90s, right. And sure. What was like more of a, intentional, like, we want to write the book this way.
Right.
So yeah, because that's the questions that this book raised for me. And we've covered, only books kind of prior to this so far, which don't really apply to that time window. I'm trying to think of anything else we've covered, like not in this round, but like in previous episodes. Mm-hmm.
That is kind of around the same time period as this. Kind of
around that same time, yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess we've done the Nutcracker Ballet Mystery. That's 110.
But I think it's Captive Witness is the next closest one to this one that we've done, which would have, of course, before 64. This. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't apply either. So that's kind of a uncharted territory for us. We haven't really covered a whole lot of these later, digest mystery stories. So it's really interesting. So far.
I will also say, and know that it pains me to say this, I'm so sorry. This is not my best Marvin. I don't know who this girl is in this book. She is rude. She's impatient. She's still got the like scaredy cat part to her, but like, I don't know. She just was not the best that I don't know. I just felt like she was portrayed way differently than what I was expecting. I don't know.
Oh, wow. We'll have to talk about that because I didn't pick up on that so much. The only thing I feel like I really remember, which I guess we'll have to go through our summary, maybe it'll spark my memory a little bit more, but it's just like her wanting to catch the bouquet, which felt very on brand for Bess, and just like her wedding and love stuff. I don't really remember her being rude, but
I just not like mean rude or anything. I just feel like at the wedding, like weddings are kind of Bess's thing. She normally loves them. And yes, there was the, she wanted to catch the bouquet thing, but just the whole time it was like, I don't care about helping with the veil. I'm ready for this wedding to start. Like she just was not having anything that anybody was saying to her the whole time.
Felt like she didn't have empathy.
Exactly. Yes. Good way to say it. And then in the museum that we go to later, she was just like too afraid to be there. And I'm like, this is not the best Marvin, that threw herself into the back of the bad guy's cars just because she thought Nancy and George were in danger or potentially could have been in danger and did all that just to make sure that they were okay. She like, this was completely opposite of that for whatever reason. I don't know.
I did feel kind of in general that there wasn't a whole lot of time spent on the characterization of Nancy, Bess, and George. Like, we didn't get a lot of their character traits. And I think I talked about this a little bit in our last episode as well. I also noticed in that it's just like, we don't really get a lot of Nancy. Like, we don't get a lot of, like, reflection on the case. Like, sometimes we'll get, like, little bits where they kind of, like, theorize. They'll be like, well, what's this about? Right. Or, like, what's happening here? But we don't get any, like, well, I think this because of that. Or, I really want to go after this suspect for this reason. Or, Bess being like, guys, be careful. Right. Or, like, I really don't want to do this. We don't get any of that. Or George being like, come on, no, we can do it. Or we don't get any of that, which is, it just feels kind of like a mystery in a vacuum when we don't have like our characters grounding it with their character traits. So I think in general, it doesn't feel like our characters are present. Bess specifically, I don't know, but in general, I definitely feel that as well. So, yeah.
Also, this is probably just because we were just in Salem and we just played Midnight in Salem, but I was really disappointed with the depiction of the city of Salem here. We'll get to this when we actually talk about the part in the book when they go to Salem, but I felt like the reasons they went did not make any sense. And I think I have a theory that maybe the whole My File theory plays into this a little bit. Maybe that scene was changed a little bit and then they took something out to make it a little bit more toned down. That's the only thing that I can come up with of why that scene was so weird and brief and seems so unnecessary, but
We're going to have to talk about that in depth too, because it is totally random and it doesn't matter mm-hmm. to the plot at all. And so it's very interesting that they threw that in there. And they even talk about it on the back of the book. Like, it's going to be like this big thing.
Yeah. They're there for like less than a chapter.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't come up again. Yeah. So anyway.
No. Anyway, let's do our three words. And then we can dive in. So I don't know.
You would think like love or wedding or romance would be like number that. One. The wedding's over after like chapter two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was really hoping for some good like Grey Fox in wedding-y vibes. We didn't get that at all. So no. Not wedding, but I don't know what it would be.
I had this thought. I was like, yeah, it's definitely not like love or weddings or anything like that, but it's kind of like weird like relationship, like weird, like the relationship's weird.
Weird like dynamics like between everyone.
Yes, mm-hmm. between everyone. Like people connecting in an awkward way.
Yeah.
Like in an uncomfortable vibe. Like I think about Meredith, who is our bride, and our, you know, victim kind of. I think about her and her relationship with her ex-boyfriend, Tony Fisk, which is very prevalent in this book, that relationship. And then I think about, you know, Cecilia and the relationship with her husband, mm-hmm. and Cecilia and the relationship with, you know, spoiler alert, her brother. And yeah, it's just all kind of weird. And then Meredith's relationship with her grandmother even is kind of like weird and on a wrong foot.
Yeah.
Families.
Weird families.
I like that. That's what it is. Weird families. And then I also think it's just like East Coast vacation vibes.
It very much is. Even if it's not Salem, it's very Boston. Yeah. We get a lot of like Boston landmarks, Boston history. Yeah. I like that one.
And just the amount of time that the girls spend doing vacation stuff, even when they're, like, solving a mystery, right. is a lot of time. Yeah. It's a lot of time. It's like, well, we can't really do anything. What's one day going to hurt? We might as well go shopping and go to a play and, right. like, do all this stuff. And it's just totally just, like, they'll spend a paragraph and it's like, and then they spent the next day sightseeing and they went to lunch here. Then they went shopping and then they saw a play. That's literally like mm-hmm. a paragraph in the book. So it's like boom, 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 boom. By the way, don't worry. They're still doing all this stuff, which I do kind of love. Like, I'm going to be honest.
Jeez, were they here for a whole week? That's a lot of stuff that they were doing.
Yes. They rode the swan boats. They went to the Boston Commons or whatever. Like, they went to Filene's basement. I'm not lying. Like, so this is all in the book, you guys. So
they threw fake tea in the harbor several times, I think.
No, I think it was just the
one. Oh, just the one. Well, Nancy was the tea was the second time.
Yeah,
but
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so East Coast vacation vibes.
Limos,
weird
definitely.
Family. And yes, I think limos. Mm-hmm. Because the amount of limos in this book is a lot more than you would expect.
Well, we have like the bride and groom leave in a limo. And then Cecilia mm-hmm. has her limo that she's wandering right. around in. And then there's just like other random limos. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Limos.
Limos. Perfect.
Great. Okay. Anything else you want to say before we jump in?
No, I mean, we can talk about the cover, I guess, but...
Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah. It's just Nancy standing what looks like on the cobblestone streets of Boston, and there's a veil next to her. And it's an ugly veil. Sorry.
Wait, what cover do you have? Oh, we have different covers.
Okay, never mind.
Okay, never mind. Now we have something to talk about.
Yes.
Yeah, so mine's a minstrel edition. Is yours Aladdin or what?
Oh, it says minstrel on mine too. Oh, no, this must be an Aladdin. Is it? No. It says minstrel.
Hmm. Interesting. This was printed May 1988. It's the first printing.
Mine's definitely a later printing. Does it say?
Yeah.
Oh, it says first printing May 1988.
Oh, maybe that says it all. Then never mind. Maybe that's not what this is.
Yours is definitely an earlier cover, though, because that format is definitely earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I've got through number 160 listed in the front of the book, so.
I only have 83, which is this one. Interesting. Yeah, so no, my cover is of, it's kind of a scene that's not in the book that I can remember. Nancy is standing on some kind of street with a building behind her, presumably in Boston. She's in a blue dress and holding the veil while some guy is like reaching out trying to grab her. And that doesn't ever happen as far as I can remember. There's no point in time where Nancy is in possession of the veil and someone's trying to get it from her. I guess
sort of.
I guess when she blows up the pictures and then what's his name gets her in the car.
I think
maybe
so.
Maybe that's what this is supposed to be.
It must be.
But I think it's a fine cover.
I like that cover better. It's a lot more exciting than mine of just Nancy looking over her shoulder and the veil weirdly floating next to her.
This is definitely an action scene, right? Mid-action, mid-pose. And I think that the color of Nancy's dress is good, but it's a boring dress.
Yeah.
I feel like Nancy, that's not something Nancy would wear, but, you know, it was the 80s, so it looks like a sweatshirt dress. Do you guys know what we're talking about when I say that?
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But she's got her, you know, beautiful blue eyes looking over her shoulder, looking like she's trying to get away, but she doesn't look scared, which I appreciate. She's just wary, just trying to get away. So, yeah, I think it's good. I will say, though, that if that is supposed to be the guy who is following them, he's supposed to have an earring.
Right.
I don't see an earring.
Could be the other ear.
It's true.
He's only showing us one, so.
That's true. You have a bad guy with an earring, like, give us the bad guy with the earring.
Paint
on
it
the
on
cover.
There.
You know? Sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, looks like mine was illustrated by Frank Sofo. Or Sofo, S-O-F-O.
My book does not have any information about that. Oh, no, just kidding. It does. Bob Baron.
Okay.
1988.
Well, Bob, I like yours a lot. It's a pretty one.
Yeah. That's the cover. Should we get into it?
Let's do it.
Okay. So we start off and Nancy, Bess, and George are at a wedding in Boston for a childhood friend of George's named Meredith. And George is a bridesmaid in this wedding. And we kind of just like randomly out of the blue, unrelated to anything, learn that Meredith's parents tragically died in a plane crash when she was 8. Of course, this is going to play into the story later, but we just learn it right off the bat for some reason. Nancy and Bess are sitting in the church waiting for this wedding to start when George approaches them and tells them that Meredith's veil is missing and Meredith will not get married without it. So we're at a standstill. And George apparently told Meredith that Nancy was a detective. And so Meredith wants Nancy's help to find this veil so that they can get the wedding started. When we talk to Meredith, we learn that the veil originally belonged to her grandmother who raised Meredith right after her parents passed. So this veil is very important to her as a way to like honor her grandmother. And also apparently her astrologer, Meredith's astrologer, said that if something was going to be lost or stolen on her wedding day and she didn't get it back, that her marriage would be shrouded in a cloud of bad luck. So that's also kind of why this situation is really high stakes for Meredith. She puts a lot of stock in that. And so she thinks that she really has to find this veil. Otherwise, it's game's over. So Nancy asks when the last time Meredith saw the veil was. And Meredith said that she was just about ready to put it on when the minister's wife came to the room where she was getting ready and said that the reverend needed to see her right away. So Meredith follows this woman down the hallway to this reverend's quote-unquote office. But when she gets to the door of where this woman led her to and opens it, it's just a broom closet. It's not the office of the reverend. And then so Meredith turns around to like ask this woman like, well, what's up? The woman's just disappeared. So it's very likely that this woman had something to do with this missing veil, right? Bess and George then go track down the reverend, and the reverend says that he's actually never been married. So we definitely know that this woman was a liar. She was not actually the reverend's wife. And then suddenly we hear a young man start shouting for Meredith outside. So we all look out the window, and Meredith is like, oh, no. That is Tony Fisk, my ex-boyfriend.
Oh.
He's shown up here, probably to try to ruin the wedding. Meredith says that Tony was a jerk and she broke up with him a long time ago, but he kept trying to see her even after she and Mark got engaged. So great. Lovely, obsessive ex-boyfriend behavior. So he called her apparently last week or something and told her that he wouldn't let her marry anybody else. So this is him showing up to not let her marry anyone else. Wild. So Nancy rushes downstairs and outside to try to talk to him, right? But by the time she gets there, he's gone. And at this point, Bess and George, who have followed her, Bess notices that the white stretch limo that was parked across from the church is now gone. And she thought that it was Meredith and Mark's getaway car. And she remembers it because it had a custom license plate on it that said licorice. But there does seem to be another limo outside now. So maybe the limo that's parked out there now is Meredith and Mark's limo. And that other limo was just somebody else's limo. It's weird. this is what I meant. Limos, man. And it's a big deal in this story, apparently. Anyway, so Nancy comes up with this idea. She's like, all right, I don't know. I don't think I'm going to be able to find this veil in like the next 5 minutes, which is when the wedding needs to start. So she talks to Meredith and she says, so, hey, your astrologer didn't say when this lost item needed to be found. She just said it needed to be found at some point. So you could probably go ahead and marry Mark and then I can just find the veil later and everything is going to be fine. And Meredith's like, yeah, okay, I guess that makes sense. That's fine. And so she agrees to that and they go ahead and get married. Later at the reception, there's kind of like just gossip kind of floating around the reception hall about this big news recently. And that is that there is this, was this multimillionaire named Brendan Thorndike, and he passed away recently. But the big news is that he died without any obvious heirs to his fortune. And so there's just kind of like this unclaimed like $60 million out there that has everybody in a tizzy, right? At the reception, Nancy meets Meredith's grandmother. Her name is Rose Strauss, and Mrs. Strauss tells Nancy that she didn't care about the veil being missing and didn't think that Meredith should wear it anyway because it covered her face, and she says Meredith has a pretty face, so she shouldn't cover it with her veil. And she even tells Nancy that, you know, she doesn't even need to worry about looking for it. She should just, you know, drop it. It's not that big of a deal. But she does tell Nancy that what it looked like, because that's what Nancy was asking. And she said that it was an old handmade lace veil with a very large rose worked into the center of the back. So they're at the wedding reception. They have a good time. Bess catches the bouquet, of course. And then Mark and Meredith head off on their honeymoon. But just as they get into their limo, a small explosion happens at the back of their car, and the limo like lurches forward and crashes into a fence. Everyone's fine. Mark and Meredith get out of the car, and Nancy looks at the back of the car and sees that whatever this was just like a small explosion, I guess like a firecracker or something that someone put into one of the cans that was attached to the back of their car. And it probably was just meant to cause some smoke and noise, but not actually harm anyone. Unfortunately, of course, Meredith is very upset at this because she thinks that this is just the start of their bad luck. But Nancy calms her down and convinces her, like, you know, don't worry about it. You go on your honeymoon. I'm going to find this veil and I will have it for you by the time you get back. So Nancy, Bess, and George then go back to their hotel, which is, by the way, the Ritz.
Where else would they be staying?
They mention in that chapter that's like, oh, well, normally the girls wouldn't be able to afford to stay here, but they splurged or something. I don't know.
There's like
exactly
a discount for the wedding group or something like that.
Something
so they
like
were able to make it work. Okay.
I'm sorry. In what universe would they be staying anywhere else but the Ritz?
Right.
These girls are wealthy. Can we just, let's all just admit that the girls are wealthy. Everybody knows it.
Everyone knows it. It's fine.
I mean, maybe not Bess and George, but Nancy, at least, everyone knows is wealthy.
Right.
She is the only daughter to a very successful defense attorney. Like, I think she can afford to stay at the Ritz for a few nights, like, and pay for her friends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whatever. So they go back to the Ritz. And Nancy calls Carson and gets the name of a friend of his and the Boston PD for some help. This doesn't matter at all. But Nancy goes to the police department to ask him to track down this licorice license plate number that was on this limo that Bess saw. And he does. And apparently it's registered to someone named Cecilia Bancroft. And he gives Nancy this woman's address. The next morning, they all go to this address. It's a very wealthy neighborhood, the Beacon Hill neighborhood in Boston. I think that's something that people would recognize. And they knock on the door of her house, and they meet her. She is a woman in her 40s. She's holding a small black poodle. And apparently this dog's name is Licorice. And so she loves this dog. So the license plate is in reference to her dog.
Great.
I love that.
Yeah.
And in a very roundabout way, because Cecilia is also kind of spacey and hilarious, mm-hmm. and I really want to talk about the characterization of Cecilia later, because I find it fascinating.
Yes.
We learn that Cecilia was near the wedding yesterday to go to a dog groomer. Apparently, she just drives around in a limo. That's just her mode of transportation.
It's what rich people did in the 80s. How else would they get around?
So... but they ask her, and Cecilia says she doesn't remember anything suspicious from when she was there, but if she thinks of anything, she'll meet them at the church in a couple hours, because that's where they're headed to next. But just as soon as Nancy, Bess, and George go to leave her house, Nancy notices that Tony Fisk is standing on the other side of the street and, like, staring directly at Cecilia's house. Weird. What is he doing here? So Nancy calls to him and, like, tries to, like, approach him, but he runs away.
So then they go back to the church to do some more investigating, and Cecilia does indeed show up, but not because she remembers anything about the day of the wedding, just because she wants to hang out with them, I guess. Maybe she's just bored. I don't know. So they're going around, looking around in the church a little bit, and they find a stairwell that must have been how the fake reverend's wife, whoever it was that distracted Meredith, this must have been how she was able to disappear so quickly. So they start looking around on the stairs, and Cecilia actually finds a part of an airline ticket. This also was kind of a little bit Midnight in Salem-y, finding a airline ticket outside of, but the ticket is for someone named Markella Smith. And it says that she flew from Denver to Boston yesterday, landed just before the wedding, and is scheduled to return back to Denver tonight. So could this be the real name of the woman who was posing as the Reverend's wife?
Mm-hmm.
So then Nancy, Bess, and George go shopping. and then later that evening, then they go to the airport to see if they can catch this Markella Smith before her flight leaves. Nancy goes up to the ticketing counter and asks for Markella Smith, and she's told that there is no such person on the flight for Denver tonight. Supposedly this is like the only flight to Denver, and they're like, no, actually, there's no Smiths at all. Nobody with the last name Smith whatsoever on this flight. Okay, very weird. So they go back to the hotel, and on the way there, Bess realizes that they're being followed by a man in a silver car. George decides that she is going to try to lose this man, just, I guess, get away from him by driving really fast. I guess George just,
unsuccessfully.
Unsuccessfully. George doesn't know the area very well, so they just stay on the highway and just keep going on the highway faster and faster until they end up on the outskirts of Boston, which puts us in Salem. And then eventually they're just like, oh, the car is almost out of gas. We're going to have to stop at a gas station. Salem's right there. Let's exit the highway. Let's pull off here. So they make it all the way to the Salem Witchcraft Museum before they do run out of gas. And so, of course, they have to stop. And then the car that's been following them pulls in right behind them. Guys,
golly.
This is like the worst plan. If anybody is ever following you, drive to
the
nearest
police
station.
Yes. Go to the police
station.
Drive
there.
Which, by the way, Nancy knows where that is because she was just there the other day.
Right. So instead of going to the one in Boston, we drive, 30? We've driven from Salem to Boston. How long did that take us? 30 minutes?
We didn't drive from Salem to Boston.
No, yeah, we did.
Oh, I drove. Oh, yeah, you're right. We did.
Yeah, you dropped me
at
the airport.
Yeah, like 30 minutes. Yeah.
So we drove a whole 30 minutes out of gas, out of their way, just to go to Salem. Why? Are we going to do anything Salem-y in Salem? No. No, we're not. Don't worry about that. But so the car pulls in behind them. Bess starts to panic, though. She completely freaks out. This is, again, this is not the girl from Clue in the Crumbling Wall. You. Yes. So she gets scared, and she just decides to jump out of the car and just run for it. Doesn't know where she's going. She's going, though. So Nancy and George have no choice but to follow behind her, and they end up going in through the back door of the Witchcraft Museum, which, by the way, it's already dark, and so the whole town is, like, closed down, and it's really, you know, like, it's deserted. There's not a single soul in sight. Which is also, I don't know what it was like back in the 80s.
I think, so the Haunted Happenings, like, thing, which is, like, the whole,
the like, tourism. The rebrand. Yeah.
The tourism thing. I think that started in, like, I want to say the 90s.
Okay.
The late 90s.
Fair enough.
So, it may not have been as hopping in the 80s as it was today.
I guess. But I mean, if you have a witchcraft museum, there's still a little bit of that going on already.
Sure.
Whatever. But
well, yeah.
Anyway, so we're here. The town is completely deserted. I could never picture it that way today because it was just absolutely overrun with like hundreds of thousands of people when we were there. But so we're in the museum and they hide. But the man from the car has followed them inside the museum.
Oh, my God.
And then all of a sudden we hear a man's voice. Who's there? And Bess knocks over a mannequin, and then the lights suddenly switch on, and there's a man standing there with a... It was an axe, wasn't it? Not just a knife?
I think it was a knife, but... I mean, I don't know if it was an axe. That's hilarious if it was. Hold on.
It might have been an axe.
Oh, you're right. It was an axe. The handle was longer than he was tall. Its curved blade was as big as a watermelon.
Ew.
oh, my God.
But this turns out to be the museum curator, not the guy that's been following them. So great. I guess we're safe now. But then we hear the back door slam really, really loudly. So we can assume that whoever it was actually genuinely was here in the building with us, but they've left now. So the girls start talking to the museum curator guy and they explain how they were followed here and everything that happened. So he offers to help push their car to the gas station. Also, Bess does not like being here because she does specify that she's afraid of witches. And this is like a whole big thing that she doesn't want to be in the witch museum because she's afraid of the witches that were not actually practicing witchcraft. Anyway, so they go out to their car and they see that it's been damaged. The lid of the trunk is all bent and scratched as if someone has been like jumping on it.
My God. But it, whatever, they end up making it back to the hotel safely. But now they have a lot of questions, right? Why was that car following them? And it had every opportunity to catch up with them. So, like, why didn't it? Was it maybe just trying to scare them? Like, what's this about?
And the axe thing. Oh, also, yeah. The axe thing was just because he was setting up a display of mannequins. Right. It was like, this is
we
a beheading.
We have to talk about this later.
No one was beheaded in the Salem witch trials.
No.
And then he's also setting up burning at the stake display. No one was burned at the stake in Salem.
People might have been beheaded, like, after the Salem witch trial. Like, who am I thinking of? Was the sheriff? Was that sheriff guy? Was he beheaded?
I thought he was hung. Anyway, we can talk about it later. Okay,
whatever,
sorry,
whatever.
In the story.
The whole thing is
here.
Very interesting, and we need to talk about that more in depth in general. But so the girls are at the hotel. They're trying to like wind down from this, you know, terrifying experience they've just had. And they turn on the news, and we learn more about this Thorndike story. So apparently this wealthy guy, Brendan Thorndike, he died without any obvious heirs, like I said. But we learn that his wife, Rebecca, divorced him like 40 years ago and actually took their children out of the country. So he does have children or did have children, but he could just like never find them because his wife fled with them. Fascinating. So if his children are still alive, they would be about 42 and 43 years old now. So it seems like very likely that they could still be alive, but no one can find them. And apparently like 200 people or something have all claimed to be them or just like other relatives hoping to get a shot at this inheritance. But so far, no one has had a legitimate claim. And there's this guy named Jason Moss, who is like the head of the the Thorndike companies now ever since this guy passed away, and it's like his job and his responsibility to track down any heirs to this fortune. But everybody thinks that he's not actually like looking very hard for anybody, because if nobody else inherits the fortune, then he gets to keep it.
So. Seems like a pretty good reason to not look into things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do the bare minimum.
Seriously. It does seem, though, like if you did, like you wouldn't actually need to do that much work, though. Like if, because if you were the heir to this, like, you know, $60 million fortune or whatever, like, wouldn't you want to come forward? So, I mean, like, to be fair, I don't know that Jason Moss would actually have to do that much investigating to find out, but whatever.
That's true. Yeah.
Anyway, so the next morning, Nancy decides to call Tony Fisk. I guess, she looks up his name in the phone book, which I thought was funny. For a second, I was about to be like, I don't know how she got his number. The phone book, Becky, the phone book. Remember that thing?
We had those back then. Yep.
Yeah, we did. not that I was alive in 1988. I don't remember that far back, but we did have phone books when I was young. Anyway. Yes. Nancy calls Tony Fisk and they have this weird, cagey conversation. Nancy tries to ask him if he has the veil, but like he won't admit to it one way or another. But he does tell her to meet him at the Boston Tea Party ship at 9 o'clock. So Nancy goes there. She goes there alone for some crazy reason because Bess and George are still sleeping. I'm like, wake them up, Nancy.
Right?
Good grief. But whatever. She goes there. She meets up with Tony, and he still won't say if he has the veil or not. He's acting really weird, like simultaneously scared and aggressive towards Nancy. And he tells Nancy that if she thinks he has the veil, then she better pay him 10 grand. And then she's like, wait, so do you have the veil? And he's like, no, I don't have it right now, but I can get it.
Okay.
Very weird. So Nancy asks, I don't know how she intuits this, but I guess she does. She asks if someone else offered him money for the veil. And he says, basically, yes, but I'm not going to tell you who that was, whatever. Then he threatens her and he leaves. It's just a very weird scene. And Nancy tries to chase after him, but someone ends up pushing her into the water off the dock of this pier that she's on. So it's freezing in the water and she's disoriented, but she manages to make it back to the dock. Thankfully, there's this guy there who introduces himself to Nancy as a private detective named Harry Knox, and he just happened to be standing there, and he saw the guy who pushed her into the water, and he gives her like this very detailed description of this guy, and Nancy recognizes this description as the man who followed them to Salem last night, because she had seen him, like, you know, in the car. And Harry actually offers to try to find this guy for Nancy because he says he doesn't like guys who push young women.
Thank you, Harry.
Nancy declines this for some insane reason. Whatever. Anyway.
She's like, I can find it myself. I don't need you.
Okay. And then she goes back to the hotel. And back at the hotel, George tells Nancy that she is called every Smith in Denver.
That's quite ambitious.
Oh my God, George.
Yeah.
But she still hasn't found anyone by the name of Markella Smith. So also she contacted Meredith's grandmother and learned that there was no one invited to the wedding by that name. And so, you know, she wasn't on the guest list. Meredith's grandmother's never heard of her. So no luck there. Then we go on a walking tour. Then they go shopping. Then they go to dinner. Then they see a play. But then at the play, in the audience, they happen to see Cecilia Bancroft and notices that she's sitting there with Jason Moss, the current heir to the Brendan Thorndike $60 million. I don't know why, but for some reason, this makes Nancy think that Cecilia and Jason Moss are now somehow connected with this veil situation.
Oh, yeah.
It makes no sense. And maybe that this means that the veil is somehow connected to the Thorndike affair. Okay. Mm. During intermission, Cecilia actually spots the girls in the lobby and comes over and introduces Jason to them. Turns out Jason is her husband. Apparently, Cecilia just kept her last name when she was married. So, yeah. Cecilia and Jason recommend that after the show, the girls go to this place called the Laugh Riot Comedy Club, because the girls are, like, asking for, like, tourist recommendations in Boston or whatever. And they end up going. It's apparently a very popular club. They get there, they sit down, they order some drinks, and they start listening to the comedian on stage. And then suddenly they all start to feel very weird. Nancy gets really hot. She says her neck feels like rubber and the whole room starts spinning. Then Bess falls face first onto the table and Nancy just blacks out.
Terrifying.
Horrifying. So when Nancy comes to, she is tied up and leaning against a headstone in a graveyard. What?
Oh my gosh. First of all, no, I did. I just, it's so crazy to me. First of all, how is this comedy club not like held responsible when you see three blacked out, clearly roofied girls being carried out? Oh, okay. Yeah. Somebody,
yeah, we gotta talk about this later.
Somebody failed them big time. But yeah, so there's this body lying on her. Wait, did you say this part already?
No, I didn't say it yet. She, yeah, no. Okay. So Bess, Nancy wakes up and she sees, oh my God. I'm too excited about this scene. She sees Bess lying a few feet away from her, and Bess wakes up and then she starts screaming and because there's a body laying on Bess's feet.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Yeah, so she's like, get this guy off me. I don't know what to do here. So Nancy comes over and she's like, oh, it's not a dead body. It's actually just some guy who's like asleep.
What the heck?
Turns out he's probably just unhoused. He's in really like ragged clothes. He seems like he's just kind of unconscious. I don't know. But then a rat crawls across Bess's legs as well. And so she's like super freaking out now. So Nancy's able to get her ropes undone and then she's able to untie Bess so that they can kind of push this guy and the rat off of her now, I guess.
Oh my God.
And then they spot George. She's like laying over a few feet away from them. So they get over to her and she's okay as well. Luckily, the roofier was nice enough to bring their purses with them and just like leave them next to them in the cemetery.
Right. My God.
This is one of the things that I think maybe this was redone to make it less of a file. I think maybe somebody really did get murdered. And then, right, because it's very tropey for the files of we black out and then we wake up next to the dead body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if maybe somebody really was murdered and then they just took it out to make it, you know, less serious for the younger audience.
Interesting.
Although, I mean, there's nothing else later in the book to make us think that there's some missing murder plot line, but it just seems like maybe somebody, maybe this guy really was, maybe it was just some random person that is not involved in the story, but maybe he really was dead or something like that.
Okay, yeah. We should talk about this later because I have a theory that I think could make sense in that regard.
Very cool.
Okay.
But anyway, so they grab their purses. They're okay now. They get up. They call the police and make a report. But then they just go back to their hotel like everything's fine and like this horrible thing hasn't just happened to them.
They literally don't talk about it again.
Yeah. So now it's the next morning. They drive over to Tony's apartment. She knocks and a woman answers and is like, oh, yeah, Tony, he's gone. He paid his rent yesterday, said he was leaving for good. Actually, he said that he's going to Bermuda for like a trip. Hold on. Wait a minute. Nancy remembers that is actually where Meredith and Mark happen to be right now on their honeymoon.
Oh my God.
Oh, fantastic. So Nancy races back to the hotel room to call Meredith to warn her. But first, she gets a call from the police. Essentially, we are told that, yes, they were drugged. We know that already. But they investigated and found out that there was some guy at the comedy club who told the staff there that he was their friend and paid for their drinks. And then that's how he was able to slip something into the drinks. And then after they clearly started to feel the effects of the drugs, this guy then like goes up to the staff, is like, hey, those are my friends, I'm gonna escort them out through the kitchen. And then took them out the back door and just put them into his car. Nobody said anything. Everyone failed them at this comedy club.
I think that this is a very much a product of the time.
Fair enough.
Because I'm thinking about the 1980s and I'm thinking like, you know, the whole escorting them out through the kitchen bit, I think, is very telling. Because I think it's like this whole thing of like, you know, they should be ashamed for being so sloppy and drunk.
Right. We're protecting their dignity.
We're protecting their dignity.
By not taking them out the front where somebody can see them.
Yeah. Which is horrible. I just want to make that clear to everyone.
It is.
But I think that's what they're trying to say.
It's revolting and disgusting, and they're so lucky nothing worse happened.
Right.
But Nancy asks, or she asks, like, hey, does she kind of describes the guy that they'd seen in Salem and the guy that had pushed her off the dock, and the police are like, yeah, that sounds like the guy. So then she goes back, and George is like, hey, there was a delivery while you were just gone. So they open it up. The package is addressed to Nancy, but there's no return address. And they open it up, and inside, it's a wedding veil. Gosh. Just kidding. It is a wedding veil, but it's not Meredith's veil. It just kind of looks like it at first glance. So they call Meredith to, like, tell her, like, hey, we just got this fake veil for you in the mail. But also, by the way, Tony's on his way, might already be there in Bermuda with you, and he's looking for you. So, yeah, Meredith's now freaked out or whatever, but she's having a good time on her honeymoon, so I don't think that they really care that much. So they hang up, and then they decide that now is the time to take a day trip to Cape Cod, which happens to be where the Thorndike Mansion is. So they get there. It's gorgeous. But Nancy says that it has this sinister quality to it. they take a tour of the home. I guess now it's like set up to where you can, like a historical thing, you can go take tours. Mm-hmm. And Nancy notices that the Thorndike family crest is basically on everything in this building. Like, it's on every piece of furniture. It's on every, like, linen. Everything has it. So she kind of looks at it, and we see that it is a circle of flowers that's kind of arranged into like this net web type design. But there actually seems to be two different versions of this crest in the house. So Nancy's like looking at something in the kitchen, like the kitchen plates have the crest on it, but just something about the flowers is different than the one that was back in the bedroom. So she like sneaks, after the tour is over, she like sneaks around the house and is like taking little like tracings of all these, of all the crests, just so that she can have, I guess, like a drawing version of both versions of the crest.
Yeah.
So Bess and George are outside waiting for Nancy. So she goes out there when she's done, and they're looking at the piece of paper. I'll say that the piece of paper that Nancy used to do the drawings was the same piece of paper that Cecilia had written the address for the Laugh Riot Club on, the comedy club that they'd been at the other night. So because Nancy had that piece of paper in her purse, she just used that to do the drawings. But then when she's showing it to George, George is like, hold on. Now that I'm looking at Cecilia's handwriting on this paper that you're having here, I recognize this because I spent so long looking at that airline ticket. I can tell you this is Markella Smith's handwriting.
Okay.
Hold on.
This confused me so much. Because the way George said, I don't know if I misunderstood, but it really seemed like she was trying to say that the airline ticket was handwritten.
I don't know. What that's about. It does seem like that. I don't know if maybe like Markella had like written something on the ticket, or if it was genuinely just a handwritten ticket.
You keep going. We talk about it later, but
it is weird. I mean, technology was up to the point in 1988 that we could have had printed tickets. Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's some sort of handwriting on the ticket that looks a lot like Cecilia's handwriting. So we say, huh. Clearly, this is a fake ticket, and Cecilia made up this Markella Smith person.
Right.
We think that Cecilia actually like planted this ticket in that in the stairwell in the church where we'd gone and looked, because
makes sense.
She was the one who found it. Exactly. So Cecilia must have something to do with Meredith's veil and was doing that to like trick them to get them out of town or something. Like, she thought that doing that could get them to go to Denver to look there instead. So they decide to go pay a visit to Cecilia. But when they get there, they realize that there's like a party going on at her house. So Nancy's excellent. Like, actually, this is even better because I can just use this as an excuse to sneak in. So she just pretends to be a party guest.
Right.
And then Nancy's able to get up to Cecilia's bedroom, and she notices a photo of her there with the same man that's been following them around. And then, unfortunately, at this point, Licorice, Cecilia's dog, comes in and starts barking like crazy. And then she hears somebody out in the hallway. Clearly, the dog's barking has attracted somebody's attention. And then the bedroom door starts to open.
Oh, my God. Luckily, though, it's just a very chatty friend of Cecilia's. She doesn't seem to be concerned with why Nancy is in Cecilia's bedroom. She just kind of starts talking to her. And Nancy has the opportunity to ask this woman who the man is in the photo. And the woman says, oh, that's Cecilia's brother, Fraser.
Oh.
Nancy's like, oh, that's so interesting. I got to get out of here now. And so she ends up like feigning a dog, or not, she doesn't feign a dog bite. She like baits Licorice into like actually biting her hand. But she pretends that it's a lot worse than it is. And it's like, oh, you know, I should go wash this out or whatever. And she leaves, and ends up going back outside. And once she's outside, she tells all this that she just learned to Bess and George. And then through a sneaky phone call, which actually I loved this moment and I thought that this was peak Bess.
This was good. Yeah, definitely.
Bess is able to determine that Fraser is home right now. She basically pretends to be a wrong number, but it's very clever the way that she does it. Mm-hmm. And she's able to determine in that phone call that Fraser's home right now, but tomorrow morning he's going to go to work. So if they're wanting to sneak into his house, then tomorrow morning is going to be the best time to do that so they can look for the veil. I guess that they know where his house is somehow. I don't know how they found out this information unless the phone book also listed his address, which seems kind of unlikely.
It did used to, though. Phone books had addresses. Yep.
Well, whatever. I may have missed how they figured that information out, but whatever. The next morning, they go to his house to sneak in to look for the veil. Unfortunately, he hasn't locked any of his windows and has no security system at all. So they all just climb in through a window in the back. This is interesting. His apartment is like perfectly neat. Like he's like very, he has a very well-kept apartment. But he has like a bajillion like cabinets and closets and like tons of places where a veil could be hidden. So they start their extensive search of his apartment. But luckily, Nancy is able to actually find the veil. She Yay! Finds Meredith's veil. So they get it. They hightail it out of there. But then Nancy starts to wonder, why would Cecilia and Fraser steal this veil in the first place? What a great question, Nancy. Why are we only now asking ourselves this question? But Nancy has a theory, right? She thinks that it has something to do with the Thorndike fortune. And in fact, after taking a closer look at the veil and sketches that Nancy made of the Thorndike family crest, she realizes that the design that is on the back of the veil matches one version of the crest, like, exactly.
Ooh.
So... unfortunately at this point, Nancy had like gone to this print shop to like blow up the sketches that of the family crest that she had to do the comparison. But so while she's there, she is confronted by Fraser, who has followed her there. And he ends up forcing Nancy into his car. And George and Bess, who I guess waited in the car while Nancy was in the print shop, realize what's going on. They come over and they like try to stop him from getting Nancy into his car, but it's too late. But through the window of the car, Nancy is able to tell Bess and George that Meredith and her grandmother must be related to the Thorndikes. But then Fraser chloroforms Nancy and drives away with her.
Of course.
Oh my God. When Nancy comes to again, so much blacking out in this book. Mm-hmm. But that is one of the three words. Nancy is, you know, laying in the back seat of his car. Her wrists and legs are bound again. Apparently that's this guy's MO, knocking girls out and tying them up. How lovely. And Fraser is on his car phone. LOL. talking to someone. And based on what he's saying, Nancy realizes that he must be talking about following Bess and George in their car. And Nancy also realizes that he must be talking to Cecilia, who is now following him. So Fraser is following Bess and George, and Cecilia is following Fraser. And Nancy figures that Bess and George, you know, must be headed to Meredith's grandmother's house if they understood what it was that she said. You know, like that would be the most obvious place for them to go. And turns out, yes, they do. I guess Nancy vaguely knows where this woman lives and realizes it's like all the way in Maine. They drove all the way to Maine.
Yeah, which they go is far to yeah.
crazy. It's a couple hours, you know, from Boston. And when they get there, Frasier gets out of the car and Nancy hears Cecilia's car pull up behind him. Sorry, Cecilia's limo, because it is the limo, by the way. She's still driving her white limo. They all get out, and then Nancy overhears Jason Moss's voice as well. So Cecilia's husband, Jason Moss, is there too. And they all go inside. Well, not Nancy. Nancy is tied up in the back of Frasier's car, but all the bad guys go inside Mrs. Strauss's home. And while they're in there, Nancy is able to loosen her binds, unlock the car door, and crawl out.
Nice. Go,
Nancy. And she finds George, like, waiting for her. I guess George just made it out of the house or something.
Right.
It's kind of like a unneeded rescue, but it's funny. And they end up calling the police on Frasier's car phone. And the police basically just tell them to stall until they get there, which is like, I'm sorry. That's the direction from the police. Not, hey, get as far away from that place as you can.
Right?
It's stay there and stall until we get there. It's not, oh, protect yourself. It's no, no, no. Keep the bad guys there so that we can come and catch them.
Right. And go back into that house, by the way. Uh-uh. No.
Wild. But that is what they do. Nancy and George go back inside or, you know, go inside. And they go in, and they're all just having, like, tea?
But in the most tense, creepy little scenario you could ever imagine.
So wild. So Nancy kind of explains to Meredith's grandmother, like, why these people are here, that they're here because of this veil. And for some reason, Nancy just knows that there's a second piece of this veil that they're looking for. I don't know how she has that information. I guess she assumes that because there's two different versions of the crest, there's like a second piece to the veil with the other. I don't get it. Whatever. But she tells her that. And yeah, I guess Rose, Mrs. Strauss, Meredith's grandmother, explains that there is a matching overlay to the veil. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Nancy tells her how dangerous these people are and like you should probably just give that to them so that they don't, you know, like harm us. And so she does. We get both pieces of the veil, we, you know, put them together and we see the complete Thorndike crest. And then Mrs. Strauss, Meredith's grandmother, reveals herself, of course, to be Rebecca Thorndike, Brendan Thorndike's you know, missing ex-wife. She explains that she left her husband because he cared more about money than people and she didn't want her children raised like that. So she fled with them to Europe and changed her name to Strauss. But after a while, he stopped looking for them. And so she moved back and she stayed hidden.
But like 30 miles away.
Yeah, not that far away. I guess, you know, right under his nose. Maybe sure. Wouldn't, you know, but what is it they say is like, it's like the best way to like avoid your enemies or like if someone is looking for you, the best place for you to hide is right behind them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway.
I mean, it is smart. She's from here. Yeah. She's every right to come back to mm-hmm. the place that she's comfortable in. And like you said, she's right there. He's not going to go looking mm-hmm. right there.
And right. And so she can also know like what it is that he's doing and keep track of him.
That's a good point. Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. So she never wanted any of his money and obviously she still doesn't because she didn't come forward, you know, to try mm-hmm. to claim any of his fortune. Right. But sadly, both of her children passed away. She had a son and a daughter and both her son and daughter passed away. And the only family she has left is Meredith, her granddaughter. Right. And she knew about the veil, but she didn't even want Meredith to use it. She tried to discourage Meredith from, you know, wearing it to her wedding, but Meredith found it one day and she really wanted to wear it to like honor her grandmother. And so Meredith ended up taking like a wedding photo in the veil that got posted in the newspaper. I guess it's like a wedding or engagement announcement or something like that. And Cecilia saw it in the newspaper and recognized it, recognized the crest as being the Thorndike crest. So Cecilia and her brother hatched this plan to steal the veil so that no one else would see it, recognize it as looking like the Thorndike crest.
This is a little plot hole for me, but
yeah. Also, Fraser was, like, supposed to destroy the veil, and Cecilia's kind of pissed at him for not doing that, but Fraser said that he was actually keeping the veil as a way to blackmail Cecilia if she didn't pay him. So, you know, this is a real healthy family dynamic. But now with this full story told, Fraser tells them, hey, you guys all need to get into the car now, because I'm going to drive you off a cliff.
This ending felt very Files to me. That's another reason that I felt like it could have been potentially a file someday.
Nancy tries to explain to them, like, oh, you don't want to do that. You know, we called the cops. The cops are on their way. Like, you're going to get into way more trouble. We should all just wait or whatever. But they, like, get to the driveway and there's no sign of the cops. So,
yikes.
Ruh-roh.
So Fraser pulls out a gun and forces them all into the limo.
Can we talk about that, though, too? Like, I'm sorry, why are you forcing them to get into the limo? Why are you not forcing them to get into Nancy, Bess, and George's rental car?
You're just tying yourselves to the crime.
Are the police not going to be curious as to, like, why all these people die in this random Cecilia Bancroft lady's, like, limo? Like, what?
Also, she seems pretty partial to it. You wouldn't think she'd want to part with it for this.
Right. She's got a vanity license plate, for Christ's sake.
Oh, man. Okay. So he forces them all into the car. He forces Nancy into the driver's seat, but the car won't start. And then the bad guys are like, oh, great. Okay. So they go and they try all the other cars as well to see if maybe they can just swap cars to see which one is going to go off the edge of the cliff. But none of them will start.
This is our crack team. Crack team of criminals.
But then we hear a loud voice over the megaphone. Stop where you are. It's the police. They have surrounded us. So we all get out of the cars. All the bad guys are arrested. And then the police say, like, yeah, we've actually been around this whole time. We just needed proof that they were going to try to hurt you.
Wait, what?
Yeah, so they just, like, disabled all the cars so that they could, like, catch them in the act, but nothing bad was actually going to happen because none of the cars were going to start.
Oh, I thought, okay. I mean, I thought that they were coming and it still was going to take them a while, but they did get there in time. And then when they got there, they messed with the starters so that the cars wouldn't start, because I think they said that, like, when criminals realize that they don't have, like, a way to escape, they're less hostile.
Why not just, like, arrest them right then and there when they come out of the house? Why wait? You know, because they disabled the cars and then they all went and hid and then waited for the bad guys to, like, try all the cars.
Well, I think because if they realize that they don't have an escape avenue, they're not going to try anything drastic, right? Because
Fraser, so they just waited for them to realize,
right? Okay. And even so, there's even a moment where I don't think I put this into the notes, but there's a moment where Fraser kind of, he pulls his gun out and he looks like he's about to, like, start shooting at the cops or something, like, escalate the situation, but Cecilia basically, like, tells him, like, don't, like, stop.
Oh no, I do remember that. Okay.
And so I think there's supposed to be, like, a tension there. It's like, we want to be really careful so that nothing bad happens. I don't think the police were just, I mean, I guess in a way they were just kind of waiting.
Right.
But I think it was because I guess technically they had hostages, right? They didn't
Fair enough. Maybe it was less of a, like.
But it's a weird thing in general, because they should not have sent those girls back into the house.
No. Not at all.
Anyway, sorry, continue.
So everything's fine. The bad guys get arrested and carted off. And then later that evening, they call Meredith and we're like, hey, you need to come home now. They don't really tell her a lot about why she needs to come home. They just say, come home. And so the next morning, they meet Meredith and her husband at the airport. And because it's 1988, we're standing right at the gate when they walk through. And so is apparently all of Boston, because it is chaos in that airport. Everybody newspapers have gotten wind of the story. It's a major media event. There's reporters all around. There's just random members of the public, just like throngs of people crowding the gate. Everyone's asking her, like, what are you going to do with all the money? And she and her husband have just stepped off this flight. And they're like, what on earth is going on? They're like looking around at all these people. And then Nancy, Bess, and George and Grandma Rose are all waiting there for her. So, and the police are there as well. So the police explained that upon searching Cecilia's house, they found a red wig in her closet. So she's definitely the one who pretended to be the minister's wife at the beginning of the book. And we learned Cecilia hasn't cracked yet, but Fraser did, and he admitted to everything. So they take Meredith into this, like, room at the airport after they can kind of finally get her away from all the reporters and everything. And it's like super, super awkward because it's clear that like grandma is not wanting to she's not wanting to tell everything that happened, but she's got to now at this point. We've got to have the whole story. So it ends with hugs and crying and all that kind of stuff. But then Nancy's like, well, what about Tony? Tony Fistas, the ex-boyfriend. And Meredith is like, actually, he didn't have anything to do with the veil, but he did show up in Bermuda.
And he, oh my God.
He did show up at our like restaurant where we were having dinner and tried to pick a fight with Mark, her husband. And that landed him in jail in Bermuda.
Wait, the story gets better, guys. The story gets better.
But he has no bail money and he's in a foreign country. So what does he do? He has to call the only person in the country he knows, which is Meredith, and say, hey, can you come bail me out?
We don't know if Meredith actually does bail him out or not, but it's hilarious either way. Oh my God.
This is amazing. Yeah. And so I guess Tony got what was coming for him. But we do also learn that he, when he was at the wedding, he saw Cecilia steal the veil and then she gave him $5,000 just to stay quiet about it. But then he told Meredith that for $10,000, he would tell her who the woman was, so who Cecilia was.
Oh my God, always on the grift, this guy.
Yeah. And so obviously at the time they were like, yeah, whatever, Tony. But I guess he did really know who did it. So whatever.
For $10,000, you could have had your $60 million.
Yeah.
Right, way sooner without all this drama.
Right. So everything's all good with Meredith and her new husband and with grandma, and they all have the big happy hug moment. Mm-hmm. Everybody makes up or whatever. But there's one more person who shows up at this airport. And it is that private detective, Harry Knox, the one who saw Nancy get pushed into the harbor earlier in the book, who saw the guy that did it and offered to track him down. And he comes up and he's like, hey, Nancy, I am super duper impressed with how well you handled this whole case. And in fact, I really need a business partner. How would you feel about moving to Boston to come work for me as a private detective? Like, not work for me. You'd be my partner, but you and I would be working together in this private detective agency. And Nancy's like, you know, no, I don't think I'm really ready to do that at this time in my life. I'm especially not ready to move. And besides, I already have the two best partners anyone could ever ask for in the entire world, Bess and George. The end.
Yay. Okay. I need an alternate universe series of Nancy moving to Boston and working with this Harry Knox guy.
Right?
Because that would be so great. This hard-boiled, I don't know, something about him seems like kind of like savant-y. Like way that like he, you know, like really, he knew everything about that guy who pushed her into the into the water. He was like paying attention. So
This guy's the real deal.
See, like, his kind of, like, cold but calculating and, like, very, like, savant-y, like, remembering things matched with, like, Nancy's, like, charisma and, like, savvy, like, solving crimes together. Tell me that wouldn't be the best, like, crime procedural, like, TV show you've ever seen.
That's amazing. I love it.
But, yeah. Okay.
So here's my theory. With the file, with the whole theory that it used to be a file. I think that originally the reason that they went to Salem was not just because George drove too far out of town. It was because they were going to go track down Meredith's medium, who told her, the one who was like, you need to find the veil, otherwise you're going to be cursed. I think that they went to Salem to look for her, and then maybe because it's too supernatural.
Because it would have been like, how would she know that? We should go talk to her.
And then maybe we get more backstory or something from that, and so then we have like more of a reason to go to Salem. And then I think Cecilia and either Frasier or Tony helped murder, or not Tony, what was the husband's name?
Jason.
Either Cecilia and Jason or Cecilia and Frasier or all of the above went and murdered Tony for trying to, like, do the, like, veil.
For catching him. Mm-hmm. That's way better than what my theory was going
to
be.
and then left him as, like, a message to Nancy, Bess, and George.
Oh, my God.
So that's my theory of how this would have played out. Who do you think would have been murdered, though? I'm curious.
Well, I was kind of wondering if, like, throughout this whole business, right, like, I know they kind of play it off at the end as like Jason knew who Rose and Meredith were the whole time.
Right.
And that he's been kind of keeping an eye on them to make sure that they like didn't come out of the woodwork. Right. To try to claim this fortune. So I was thinking like, well, what if that wasn't true? And like over the course of this whole business, they discovered that, you know, Meredith and her grandmother were actually Thorndykes or whatever, and found out that, you know, maybe Meredith has an uncle or whatever. And I thought that the dead body would be they killed
the uncle.
Meredith's uncle. So I thought, I would think that like, oh, well, maybe it could be them just trying to like eliminate like other potential inheritors. But your point about it being Tony and them doing it as like a way to threaten Nancy is makes much more sense and fits so much more into the whole file kind of archetype situation.
Or maybe he even was threatening because like he found out and was like trying to do this, pay me
$10,000.
Blackmail
them for more money.
Or maybe he found out and so they were like, we gotta kill him before he goes and tells Meredith.
Yeah. I was also thinking it could be like, well, you know, maybe like Nancy, Bess, and George are trying to find other members of the Thorndyke family. It doesn't really make sense at that point, but I was like, why? The thing that I kept coming back to is this random museum curator in Salem. They go so far as to give him like a name. They spend a lot of time talking to him. There's this weird like aside where like the mannequin that he has is named Meredith.
Right.
And they, because he says something about like, oh, you know, don't mind Meredith or something. And they're like, Meredith. And he's like, oh, the mannequin. I'm talking about the mannequin. They're like, you named your mannequin Meredith. That's a weird coincidence. Right. And I was like, so maybe he's related to Meredith or the Thorndykes or something.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so maybe like that, them meeting him was some way to like loop him back into the story later as like, oh, actually it's this guy that we happened to meet, you know? The whole thing, there's some weird bits.
Also, it is just a shorter book. And I know that for the digests around this era, they were all kind of that way. They're on the like 16, 17 chapters. But I feel like if you took out all the like murder and the medium stuff, you would have had enough to get us back to 20 chapters here, you know?
Yeah, she's not a medium, she's an astrologer.
So, sorry, yeah, whatever.
No, that's okay, because I think probably they changed that. Like, I think that maybe, like, if there was a whole different, like, Salem subplot where they have to go to Salem and talk to her, then maybe she wouldn't have been an astrologer, maybe she would have been a fortune teller of some kind of divination, right?
Which we've had fortune tellers in other mystery stories, especially in the original 56, but I think that maybe the way that they were going to use that character, it would have been too supernaturally-ish for a mystery story.
Well, I can understand, too, as to why they wouldn't want to go down that route, because I do think it would kind of muddy the theme of the book.
Of course.
Because it's not supposed to be spooky. You know, it's supposed to be about it's not supposed to be that kind of vibe. It's supposed to be more Boston, high class, like the Ritz, like fancy weddings, like limos, that kind of vibe, less spooky fall Salem witchy stuff, you know.
It just felt like if we're gonna go to Salem, we needed a better reason than just George drove too far out of town,
it's
and
weird.
Somebody's following us, and Bess is afraid of witches.
Yeah, just like just, you know, I mean, like, what they should have done that would have made a lot more sense is, like, you know, they keep driving. George ends up turning down random roads. They end up at a dead end at, like, a beach or right. something. And George is like, I can't turn around because if I, like, there's, like, that guy's right, like, I have nowhere to go. And so then Bess jumps out and just takes off running down the beach. They end up hiding behind a sand dune or something. But then I guess they don't, and then, like, maybe, like, some random passerby ends up helping them.
Right.
But, like, because I think that would, like, that would jive more with, like, the whole, like, Cape Cod,
yeah.
like, Boston, like, you know,
that setting kind of would have been better. There was no, yeah. like, we don't learn anything in Salem. No. The curator doesn't help us at no. all. I mean, he literally helps us get to the gas station. That's right. fine. But he doesn't help us with the mystery at all. Like, we don't gain right. anything from no. that really long, bizarre conversation.
And if first and last name.
Yeah. And if it had been like, oh, we're going to see the medium. And even if she doesn't tell us anything about the Thorndykes, maybe she gives us a little bit more of, like, mm-hmm. what her premonition was. She'll just give us a little bit more detail of, like, why it's so bad if Meredith doesn't find it or something right. like that. And then that tips right. Nancy off, oh, maybe I should look into XYZ, and then they go back to Boston or something.
Yeah.
I like that I've just decided that this is a file. I'm just coming up with reasons to justify.
I mean, it would make a lot of sense. I mean, especially, I mean, like, Simon and Schuster, like, you know, producing both at the same time. It would make sense that, like, sometimes you probably are working on both and you've right. you've got different plots and deadlines. And I'm sure at some point it's like, well, let's just use this one for that. We can kind yep. of tone it down a little bit. Solve the problem. Move on. You know?
Easy like, enough. Yeah.
That would make sense to me. So, yeah. So I totally buy that. And it's definitely, there's definitely some intense stuff. I mean, the whole, like, drugging, like, that is straight out of the files. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I can't, like, I guess Nancy gets chloroformed a lot in the other mystery stories. And I guess she does get chloroformed in this one. But roofied, no.
That's really intense for a mystery story.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was about to say, Nancy doesn't typically get drugged. She does get drugged, but she doesn't get roofied.
Right.
That's a different thing. Yeah. What was I going to say? Also, okay, the whole thing about them waking up in, like, a cemetery with, like, a quote-unquote, like, person, mm-hmm. or I was going to say dead body, but, like, a person laying on them. Like, what the heck is that about? Like, why is there this random scene where that happens? Like, I know it's supposed to scare them, but I don't know. It just feels so out of place. Like, I don't know. I feel like I just feel like for the vibes of this book, like it just feels very muddied and muddled. Like maybe that's more along like the Salem-y vibes. Like maybe they were trying to
do
a spookiness with that, I guess. But again, it just feels out of place. And so I think, yeah, if they were going to make a scenario where they were trying to threaten the girls, then it should have been something else. Like, I don't know, locked in like a spooky house or something. I don't know. Something else.
If they're going to go through all that to roofie someone and kidnap them and just to drop them off at a public place, seems kind of weird. I don't know.
Yeah. Why would they not, one, just kill them? Like, I mean, honestly, like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Like,
sorry, but yeah.
Like, I guess what I think should have happened is not, I think maybe they get roofied, but maybe they don't get kidnapped, right? Like, maybe someone helps them. And, you know, they're like, oh God, like who, you know, would have done that? And they still could have, we still could have found out that it was that guy, but just totally avoided the whole graveyard scenario. It's just weird. Yeah. Anyway. Let's see. What else? Yeah, there was a lot of this book of people offering Nancy help and her just like not taking it.
Yeah.
Like the cop friend of her father's in Boston, he's like, hey, do you want like a police detail? Like, I can send you a couple guys to like follow you around because it seems like you're probably in danger. And she's like, nah, that's okay.
Why would I need that?
Right after she gets like pushed into the harbor. It's like, ah, Nancy. And then she ends up getting roofied. So
let people help you sometimes, Nancy. It's okay to say yes.
Okay. There is this line in the book that was shocking to me. Okay, so this is after they get roofied. They're in their hotel room. This is after they get followed to the Witchcraft Museum. They go back to their hotel room, and they're, like, stressed out. They can't sleep, so they just start turning on the TV. It's when they hear the news story and learn more about Brendan Thorndike and his heirs. But before they see that news story, they're just, like, flipping through the channels. They're just, like, watching TV. And there's this scene that comes on TV. Let's see. There's they see a game show. Okay. And then they go to flash to, like, this sitcom. The screen flipped to a family sitcom. A handsome blue-eyed father was talking to his handsome blue-eyed teenage son. "Alan, why do you always fight and argue with your sister?" the father asked. "Gee, Dad," said the son, "isn't it against the law to shoot her?" The laugh track thought it was hilarious, but Bess didn't, so she changed the channel again.
That's my best Marvin right there.
Like, what the heck? Okay, but also just, like, what a great, like, Bess, like, mm-hmm. Bess is the one who's like, nah, that's crap.
Yeah.
And turns it off. Like, I thought that was insane. What's supposed to be funny about that? Is that supposed to be a line on a TV show in the time? Is that lines that people made in the 80s, like, about shooting your sister?
Shooting women is hilarious. Didn't you know that? It's like, so
what
funny.
What the hell?
Harm someone for anyway. What? Existing? Being annoying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Being a woman? Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Oh, there was a very funny moment where Nancy's, like, eating, like, dinner, eating, like, a salad or something, but it specifically says, "Nancy ate the strips of cheese off her chef's salad."
Same girl, same.
And I was like, hashtag relatable. Like, like, so funny. I don't know who wrote that line, but I was like, you get it. You get it. Like, whoever that is gets it.
Love it.
Okay. Something else I wanted to talk about was Ned. We obviously don't get Ned in this book, but there is a moment where we write a little postcard to him.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. Where is it? Oh, 37. Yeah, okay. So this is before this is very early on in the book, like right after they meet Cecilia, before they're going to go back to the church to investigate. And they end up stopping somewhere and buying postcards and getting, like, some refreshments or something. And as they drank their soft drinks, they wrote out their postcards to Nancy's boyfriend, Ned Nickerson, who was a student at Emerson College. "Having a wonderful time, wish you were here," wrote Nancy. Bess wrote on this same postcard that's being sent to Ned, "Nancy's name has been linked with a Tony Fisk. Aren't you dying?" And then George's note was the shortest of all. "Don't believe Bess." Like, Bess! Stirring up trouble. Are you dying?
Okay, I take it back. That's our girl. I love her.
I just thought that was so hilarious.
You're very characteristic. Yes.
It's so funny to me how throughout literally all of these books, everybody knows and notices the relationship tension between Nancy and Ned, and how Ned is always jealous that Nancy is off doing all this stuff, and everybody makes fun of it. It's like an unspoken secret. Everybody knows.
Good Lord.
So, yeah, love it. So there were some really funny moments in this book. And I think, like, in general, like, there was enough, like, kind of, like, what? Like, what's going on? To make it, you know, marginally entertaining. I wouldn't say I was, like, you know, glued to my seat or anything. But I think it's pretty good, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that's all I've got about it. Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. What else you got?
Yeah. Not much, I don't think. Not much else. So, the Lashlight score?
Oh, that's a hard one. I didn't dislike it, definitely. But yeah. Like you said, it's not like, it's not the best in the world. Yeah, it doesn't stand out. I'm not super wild. I'm going to give it a 3. I think a 3 is nice and even.
I think I would give it a 3.5.
Okay.
3.5 Lashlights, because I think it's verging on good. But again, yeah, it's just not super memorable. But I also don't think it's like just middle of the road. You know what I mean? Like, I think it deserves a little bit. There's some good parts in there that make it more enjoyable than less enjoyable. Sure. You know what I mean? It's not truly neutral. So I think 3.5 is what I would give it. But overall, yeah, it didn't stand out to me. I think we didn't get enough characterization of Nancy Bess and George.
No.
I think they didn't quite understand the theme of what they were trying to go for. There were some extraneous things in there that didn't need to be in there. But overall, I think a fun time, you know? Yeah.
I wonder if it had been published as a file with all the more like salacious stuff in there that I've decided was supposed to be in there that it was originally intended to be, maybe I would have given it a 4. I don't know. Maybe that would have been enough to make it exciting, enough right. to tie in the like Salem thing that didn't really feel relevant at all. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would have been enough. But yeah, I think 3 is sorry yeah. for this one. Yeah.
Yeah. There is a part of me that is like, either go for it or don't. You know
sure.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we get a gun in this book. So, yeah. you know, gun and car chases, but it always does kind of feel a little bit like edging. Like it's just kind of like, oh, something really bad's going to happen. And then, then nothing kind of does. So I think aside from the roofie situation, which I definitely think was the most horrifying.
Yeah.
The most time Nancy was in extreme danger was probably when she was pushed off the pier.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably when her life was most at stake.
Of course.
I guess with when they were like threatening to push them off the cliff or drive them off the cliff, but that wasn't actually going to happen. And we all knew that wasn't going to happen.
Right.
So, you know, yeah.
I also, not that the predictability of the plot line is ever the deciding factor in how we score these, because it usually is pretty predictable and how things play out. But yeah. I felt this one was especially predictable. Yeah. I'd figured out the Thorndike thing by like chapter 4. And
right.
then really the most mysterious thing is like, how do Jason and Cecilia know each other? And as soon as it was like, oh, they're married. It's like, oh, okay, that explains it. And there's no other suspects really aside from Tony. And then Tony just turns out just to be a nuisance.
Definitely. I mean, like, the Thorndike thing was off. I mean, like, why else are we talking about this? And why are we talking about the fact that Meredith, happens to have no parents? Like, of course.
I just couldn't decide if Grandma Rose, like, was the wife, or maybe she was, like, the sister of the wife somehow. I didn't know if she was specifically,
I kind of wish that it was Grandma Rose who stole the veil.
That would be clever.
Like, she was trying to steal it so that Meredith wouldn't walk down the aisle with it because she didn't want anyone to know.
To see
right?
it. But then why she didn't realize.
Maybe she didn't realize that that's the picture that she sent to the newspaper.
Oh,
maybe she
I
didn't see it or something.
That's kind of a plot hole for me as well. I think I know that it's totally normal to get, like, bridal photos done ahead of your wedding where you put head to toe on everything that you're going to wear on the actual day of, and then you take photos, and then maybe you
post it in the newspaper.
You don't post it in the newspaper. You might display those photos, like, at your wedding or, mm-hmm. like, send them to people after the wedding, but, mm-hmm. like, the dress is supposed to be a surprise. Why would you tell everyone weeks before the wedding in the newspaper announcement, hey, this is what I'm going to wear on the day of?
I kind of assumed that it was just a headshot. Like, it was shoulders up of her face in the veil. I don't know why. Because I do think that typically in newspapers, I mean, this is just totally my imaginings of what you would do. But I think that, like, when you post, like, full body pictures in the newspaper, it loses a lot of definition because
of
the way that the printing works. So, I mean, like, if it were me, I would... And it was like, you know, an obituary or whatever. Whatever reason I'm sending a photo to a newspaper.
You're doing a headshot.
I would do a headshot. I would never do a full body. So
that definitely makes sense. But then you would have to have at least long enough to have the whole veil in the photo, which means mm-hmm. it's probably like her like looking from like over her shoulder or something,
right.
like taken from the back and she's looking.
Presumably.
In which case you would be able to see the dress, which still kind of negates that. And why would you post this picture? Not post it. Send it in. Obviously, you're not post the newspapers. Publishing it.
It's 1988, Corey.
Yes,
remember.
1988. This isn't Instagram. No. It still just kind of like defeats the purpose of like nobody sees you in your wedding day attire until the day of.
Yeah.
I don't know. And that's
which
whatever.
Seems like in the 80s, that's probably something that you would really care about.
Right.
These days, probably maybe not, but like in the 80s, we were
wedding traditions were very.
Yeah. Big deals.
Yeah. And maybe Meredith wasn't that way, but it like mm-hmm. nothing indicates to me that she would have been. just sharing with the entire world, like, hey, here's what I'm going to be wearing in a couple weeks. And that gives the bad guys enough time to, like, plan out this whole plot now that they know she has it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Also, why would grandma not want her to have the money? Even if, like, the money is from not so great of a source.
Oh, wait. We should definitely talk about grandma. We haven't really talked about grandma.
True. Okay.
Roll back the tape. Yes. We're not done. Just kidding, you guys. Yeah. No. What's up with this lady? Because... I mean, I, you know, we don't know what happened between her and her husband. It could have been a lot. And I definitely get why you would probably want to leave someone who is obsessed with their money. And probably, there's probably a lot of subtext to that there, right?
Of course.
Like, probably he did not treat them well or whatever it was. And she left.
I have no doubt that that's all valid.
Right. But she fled with her children. And, like, first of all, that's kidnapping.
It could be, depending on the divorce agreement, it could be, definitely.
Well, I don't know if they were divorced, like, because, I mean, like, I assume at this point he must have probably had the marriage annulled.
Maybe.
Right, because that's what you do, and you can't find someone, I remember this from Veronica Mars.
You have to post it in the newspaper and give them time, yep.
Yes, and then after, like, a certain amount of time, if they haven't responded, then you can dissolve the marriage and marry whoever you want. So I assume at some point that happened, but I think she just fled because I understand he's got a lot of money. And so it was probably like, she probably had legitimate reason to want to do that. I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, she shouldn't be fleeing her husband that way, but what she did was technically kidnapping, right? So she kidnapped her own children, from their father. And I mean, because all the book tells us is just because she didn't like the money situation and the way that the money situation was making him act, which doesn't seem like a good enough reason to me.
Well, and then, we don't know what his behavior was. People get up to some shady stuff when they feel like they have the money to protect them. Yeah.
I'm just saying that the reason that the book gives us is not enough.
Of course. Yeah. And maybe the book was just toning down the explanation of
I'm sure.
You know.
I'm sure. But then once he has passed away, to then still want to keep your granddaughter from, like, life-changing money, there must have been some real trauma there for her with money.
It's not like Brendan's going to know that they took his money or accepted his money, right? Like. Mm-hmm.
But the vibe that it gives off is that she thinks that money makes people bad.
Of course.
Like, it just spoils people. And
she doesn't
want
Meredith to end up that way.
Right.
Which is valid.
Yes, but it's just interesting. I will say, though, Meredith is 20 years old.
She's a baby.
She's little. So, like, maybe Grandma Rose has reason for this. I don't know, but... Yeah.
There's responsible ways. You could donate it to charity or whatever and
Absolutely.
Then keep a small amount for yourself that you, like, put into savings and only use if you
Buy
need
a
it.
House.
Right, exactly.
At least. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, okay.
So that's grandma.
So 3 flashlights and 3.5 flashlights. We thought we were done, you guys, so guess we're not. But yeah, I think that's all I have to say at this point.
Sometimes you got to go back over it again. It just gets too exciting.
Do we want to talk about what we're going to be covering next?
Yes. I don't even know what we're covering next, actually.
Oh, I'm so excited to tell you, Corey. Because we are going to be covering another Nancy Drew Digest, of course, number 111, The Secret at Solaire.
Ooh.
And I don't know if you know what this one is about, Corey.
I do not, no.
Let me just read the back for you because I'm hyped for this. Okay. In search of a saboteur, Nancy finds that every desert trail leads to danger. Nancy, Bess, and George are spending a week at the exclusive spa Solaire outside Tucson, Arizona, a place for relaxation, rigorous exercise, and complete beauty makeovers. But they soon discover a much more sinister aspect to the Solaire program when an unexpected visitor welcomes them to their cabin, a poisonous black widow spider. Every new activity poses a new risk to the staff and guests, beginning with sabotage and ending in kidnapping. The key to the case is Jacqueline Rozier, the world-famous model who runs Solaire, but what is she afraid of, and what shocking truth is hidden in her past? Nancy must find the answers before the desert campaign of terror takes its final fatal twist.
Love it. Love a desert mystery.
Desert! Desert spa, which is like, yes, please.
Sounds fantastic.
Please. And I will say about these digests, we get Bess and George in every single one.
I love that too. Yeah. I'll take it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
More Bess and George, please.
And no Ned to be seen, you guys. No Ned anywhere.
No Nickerson would be caught dead at a wellness spa. Come on now. Getting like, his Nancy, nails done. Facials.
Nancy,
no.
What are you doing there? Nancy, come back to River Heights. You told me we were going to go on a date.
I can't take a mud bath. I have football practice. That is my mud bath.
Enjoy your sticks and twigs, Nancy.
Yes. Okay. Well, that sounds like it's going to be a fun one. Yeah. I'm excited for that.
Let's talk shit-talking Ned. join us next time for Nancy Drew, The Secret at Solaire.
Yeah, we'll see y'all then.
Thank you for listening to Regular Nancy Drew. Email us at regularnancydrew@gmail.com.
If you like this episode, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe.
You can also follow us on Instagram at @regularnancydrew and Twitter at @regularnd.
You can also support us on Patreon. Patrons at the $3 level vote on upcoming episode topics and get exclusive access to our Scoop Sesh series.
And all patrons receive early access to each episode as well as weekly bonus content.
And to all you regular Drews out there, thanks for listening.